for some review of about 300 years of history to try to bring us up to date of what we're dealing with Nehemiah. Back at about 722 BC is where we'll start with the account here. That gives us the timing of the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel to the Assyrians. And from there, as we follow on down through, God was using one nation after another. And this one may be just a little small on this transparency. I hope you can see what we've got here. But he was using one nation against another. And in 612 BC, brought the Assyrians themselves down. They had been his instruments of judgment against other nations, and now they were themselves being judged by him. They were overcome by the Babylonians. Now what that accomplished was not just that one nation fell, but that an empire fell. And so basically what the Assyrians had controlled now was under Babylonian control, except it also put them in a position of being somewhat vulnerable. They were just now rising to power, and some of the others, particularly further from the Mesopotamian area where that was centered, saw this as an opportunity to try to threaten the Babylonians and try to regain some of their control. The Egyptians particularly, at this point, tried to launch an attack against them and to come back and regain some of the control. So for a while, the territory of Palestine becomes kind of in the middle of all that's going on. And that worked for God's purposes as well, because he had been warning the people of Judah, the southern kingdom, that they also were going to fall. And by 606 or 605 BC, there was the first carrying away into captivity of the people of Judah. This is the time that Daniel, for example, was taken into captivity. And that's where we mark normally the beginning of the captivity of the people of Judah. Because of some more problems that arose in Judah while they were being allowed to govern themselves back at home, a few years later there was a second deportation, about 597. And in 586, things got bad enough that the Babylonians just got fed up with it all and wiped them out. Now, I'm dealing with that from the political perspective. Realize, of course, God's hand is controlling all of this. He had offered warnings using these nations and now finally was bringing down the nation of Judah because of their disobedience and their violation against him. Well, then, at about 539 BC, Babylon itself fell. And there's some interesting things about this because these events that we're looking at in this time range had been prophesied through Isaiah particularly 200 years earlier. Very specifically prophesied, even to the point of naming the king who would overthrow the Babylonians. Cyrus was prophesied by Isaiah writing back around 700 or so BC. Cyrus then and Darius the Mede, who seems to have been kind of a second in command, if you will, were in a position then of being able to rule over the empire that the Babylonians had. And within a year of Cyrus coming to power, he issued one of the most familiar of edicts in the Old Testament, the Edict of Cyrus. It's recorded at the end of 2 Chronicles and the beginning of Ezra. It tells us where he gave the allowance for the people to return and to resettle their own lands. Now, that brings out something that's kind of interesting in the history that's involved here. God, of course, is controlling the interaction between all of these different nations. But the different empires that we've talked about, Assyria, Babylon, and now the Medo-Persians, each chose a different style of subjecting other kingdoms. The Assyrians, when they came in and they took over a land, chose a policy of what we would term resettlement. They would come in and they would take, for example, the best out of Israel, and they'd move them off somewhere else. Then they would take some other people from some other land they had conquered and move them in and mix a few of them up. And the result was a mixture to where there was not enough control in any one nation that they would be able to have the power to rise up against the kingdom itself or the empire and try to overthrow it. That's where the Samaritans come from. Because their bloodline was so corrupted by the intermingling of so many people over a period of several hundred years prior to the coming of Christ. So the Samaritans were looked down upon as half-breeds by the people of Judea in the time of Christ, because their bloodline had been corrupted over a period of 700 years. The scattering of the northern kingdom effectively brought it to an end. And while there were some individuals and they were given an opportunity to come from various parts of the world under Cyrus, the northern kingdom and its identity as such was pretty well lost at that point. And so from the time that they are taken out of the picture, when we read references to Israel, which for a while had reference to the northern kingdom, Now the concept is Israel again in the sense of God's chosen, and more literally to the people of Judah or to the spiritual kingdom of Israel. So then from that point, that was the Assyrian policy. The Babylonians came into power and they chose a different policy. They would deport the best of the people and take them back to their center of power. That's how Daniel and many of the others, the finest young men of Judah, were taken into Babylon and groomed for particular training and such there. They would leave the poor and the lower class peoples in their own land. And thus, there was able to remain in Judah a group of the Jews, or what were becoming known as Jews as time went on, who were able to stay there. And we see, for example, some of the prophets able to stay there during that time. The Medo-Persians took a whole different approach. They chose to allow people to be in their own land, to have a degree of self-rule greater than these previous two empires had done. And that allowed not just the people of Judah to return to rebuild the temple, but allowed people to return to a lot of different kingdoms throughout the world where the Babylonians had taken conquest. Okay, from 538 then, the Edict of Cyrus is issued, and within a couple of years or so, the people return back to the land under Zerubbabel to begin the rebuilding process, to rebuild the temple, to rebuild eventually the walls around Jerusalem. And that's where we get our 70 years, as the Bible speaks of, from 606 to probably about 536 that the actual return took place, would give us the 70-year captivity span. Then, after the people had been back there for about 15 or 16 years, the work was stalled. They still didn't have much more than the foundation of the temple laid. Haggai and Zechariah rise up at about 520. One of them works for a few months, one of them for a couple of years in public prophesying for the primary purpose of motivating the people to rebuild the temple. The book of Haggai is one of the most challenging in the Old Testament in that respect. It's one that I sometimes preach from because of the challenges that are there, getting us to get to work and not to be making excuses for ourselves. And that's what really the message of these two prophets was. By 516, the temple was completed. Now, there was still finished work and beautification and such to be done on it after that, but the basic temple itself was completed by that time. Then, in 458, Ezra returns. Now, much of the material of historical background in this time period, from about 536 down to 458, is provided in the first several chapters of Ezra. Ezra finally gets to his own work at about chapter 7, and the rest of the book then deals with what he did when he got back there. At 458, he got back primarily with a concern for straightening out the spiritual problems of the people. And Ezra was challenging them to get rid of, for example, some of their idolatrous corruptions where they had intermingled with the peoples from around them. And now we get to Nehemiah, which is where we're working from today. Nehemiah came back at about 442 and worked as governor there. He had been a cupbearer for the king and had been allowed now to return by the Persians. He was back there to work to try to get the people motivated to the rebuilding of the walls. The prophet who is contemporary with part of the work of Nehemiah would be Malachi. And this brings us down to the close of the Old Testament. Really, the book of Nehemiah and Malachi, those two books would be the last ones in the Old Testament chronologically. So Nehemiah is there for the purpose of trying to get the people to work at rebuilding the walls. And he went out and he surveyed the circumstances of the walls after he got there, saw what needed to be done, and finally got to work at getting the people to do it. Now, the very thing that had kept them from rebuilding the walls over many of those years was still there as a problem. They were facing not only a lack of motivation from within, but threats from without. There were other people around them that did not want Jerusalem to rise to its glory again. And they were making all kinds of efforts to stop them. And that's where we come into chapter 4 of the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is in the process of getting the wall rebuilt. The people are working at it. They've got it up to about half of its height, all the way around the city. But there are still threats from outside. I'd like to begin reading at verse 10. And the section as a whole, I've labeled based on one of the verses there, fight for your family. And that's the focus that I want us to try to draw out of this passage as we apply it in our own circumstances today. Let's begin, though, at verse 10. Then Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall. And our adversary said, 'They will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease.' So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, From whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Therefore I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. In this opening section here, we've got the idea of some warnings that are being given. The work has begun, the wall is up halfway around, and they come in and they say, we're not able to work on the wall because of all the rubbish around us and because of the threat of the attack. Well, they didn't just say it one time. 10 times these Jews come in and they say, we are being threatened by the attack from others around us. And so they're constantly concerned that they are going to be overcome. And I believe in that there is a message for us. And as we're going to be drawing some application lessons out of this as we go through the text. None of us like what we would sometimes describe as negative preaching. We don't like rebuke. I don't like it. I don't like it when somebody's up there preaching and I feel like they've got my number and I walk out and my toes are all sore. We don't enjoy that sort of thing. What we would really like is what we might describe as positive preaching. The things that will always be encouraging and uplifting and upbuilding, but we'll never really get down to saying, this is wrong and it's got to be changed. Because when we tell ourselves that we've got to change, that requires some real soul searching and maybe giving up things that we like. But there is a danger when we tire of warnings of sin and when we want to shift away from such warnings. What would have happened in this case? Here come the people, the Jews, 10 times. They're going to sneak up on us and catch us off guard and attack us. What if they had tired of the warning? You know the old wolf-wolf story? What if they had just gotten to the approach of, oh, we've heard that before and it hasn't happened yet. Just go on to talking about other things. Get back to work on the wall and don't be worrying about these enemies coming. If that had happened, we'll see that they would have faced some problems because it was necessary for them to take action to defend against the threat. We need to realize the threat of attack in our lives and recognize the consequences if we are defeated. And as the emphasis here is going to be somewhat on the family, some of us are parents, some are grandparents. I don't know how much further it goes than that, whether we've got great-grandparents in the group tonight, this morning or not, but at least we can get to the point of having some who care about families. All of us recognize the threats that there are against our own families. And we've got to take those threats seriously and recognize the severe consequences if we are attacked and we lose. Because we are attacked. We will be attacked. Our families are threatened from all around the wall all the time. We have got to be conscious of those and not tire of the warnings. I wonder sometimes about some of the preaching that Paul did. Turn over to Acts 20 for just a moment. And when we get into the emphasis on all positive and no warning, no rebuke, I wonder what we would have done with the Apostle Paul or some of the other preachers that we read of in the New Testament. In Acts 20, verse 26, Paul says, therefore I testify to you this day that I am innocent of the blood of all men, for I have not shunned to declare to you the whole counsel of God. Therefore take heed to yourselves and to all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God which he purchased with his own blood. For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. Also from among yourselves men will rise up, speaking perverse things, to draw away the disciples after themselves. Therefore watch, and remember that for 3 years I gave you all positive preaching, and every 6 months I gave you a little bit of warning. Whoops, missed something there, didn't we? Look at what he's saying in that 31st verse. For 3 years I did not cease to warn everyone night and day with tears. Paul took the warning seriously, recognized the needs of their repeat, and now as he's visiting with these Ephesian elders for just a very short time, what's he doing? Take heed, be careful, trouble's coming, attack is there. We need to recognize the threat of attack and the serious consequences of defeat. Can you just imagine some of those Ephesians saying, oh, well, Paul's in town again, and you know, all he ever talks about is sin and temptation and repentance and the judgment to come and all these negative things. Well, I'm not saying that all of our preaching ought to be negative. We do need encouragement. We do need uplifting. But we need the encouragement that is really going to give us courage to conquer sin. That's the very concept of encouragement, to embolden us to the battle. And that means we've got to recognize that there is a battle to be fought. And sometimes it involves the things that we might classify as a bit negative. Well, as we go back to Nehemiah chapter 4, In verse 14 is where I've drawn the title for the lesson, just by kind of summarizing the message that's there into this idea of fight for your family. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Now, obviously, we are dealing with physical battles of a physical city, and he's talking about physical houses in this particular case. We've got to make the application, though, to the spiritual battle in a spiritual city that involves spiritual houses and households, and realize that we need to fight to secure and maintain a place in the city of God just as surely as they had to. There needs to be an urgency of concern for our families. We need to realize, as we think of our brethren, as we draw one of the words from this, that we need to be seeking the salvation of those that we love. Those that we love, whether it's a fleshly relationship, a family kinship, or those who are in a spiritual family. That we need to be seeking the salvation of those. He also said they needed to fight for their sons and daughters. There's an interesting question that's posed in the New Testament for us. One of those challenging ones. Of what will you give in exchange for your soul? To describe of a man, would he sell it for the whole world? And if he gains the whole world, what has he gained? And we can recognize that question and how it needs to be answered in our lives, and that nothing in this life is worth sacrificing my soul over. I want to suggest a little variety on that question. What will we give in exchange for our children's souls? You see, we can recognize that we don't want to sell our souls. But at what price will we sell the souls of our children? What things will we allow to interfere with the spiritual nourishment that they need? Will we allow it to be a career of either parent, that will cause us to be selling the souls of our children? There needs to be an emphasis in our society on the responsibilities that we as parents have in the home. There needs to be an emphasis on the responsibility of mothers to be providing the needed nourishment of children as they are maturing. And we need to be very careful with the choices that are made regarding careers. We're in a society that has downplayed the importance of the role of being a housewife, a mother, a homemaker, as it's described in some versions of the Bible. Has acted as if a woman has no basis for viewing herself as important or worthwhile if the primary occupation of her life is her family. Nothing could be further from the truth of the Word of God. There is no nobler calling for a woman in this life than to take that responsibility of the guidance of those young, impressionable minds as they are maturing. And we need to be careful that we as Christians don't allow the forces of society around us to act as if a woman who may not have a great deal of education, may not have pursued these great careers and climbed up the ladder of success in the world's eyes, to allow it to be given as if she's unimportant in some way. In many cases, those are the most valued women, most valued people that we have around. And our society is suffering greatly because of a de-emphasis on that role. We've got to recognize that a career is too low a price tag to put on the souls of our children. But I don't want to leave it just at the women. It's too easy for us to do that, especially when we as men get up here talking. We as men can sacrifice the souls of our children for our careers as well. And we need to think about it. How many times are we so wrapped up in the advancement up the ladder that we don't spend the time, and we're not there when our family needs us, or that we choose to accept certain types of promotions or even transfers that take us away from our family or take our families into terrible situations for their souls? We need to remember the lesson of Lot, the choice that he made. And there are times that, yes, we can move into situations where we can be very valuable to the cause of Christ and our family can be challenged and helped to grow, but we need to take it seriously and realize the dangers that come sometimes in choices that we make. But not just career, what about the concept of money in general? Financial prosperity. Sometimes it may be the second income. It may be the extensive overtime hours for the purpose of accumulating what? Laying up riches for ourselves in this life at the expense of our children's eternal souls. In many cases, that's exactly the trade-off that's being made. And we can run from that, and we can argue all day long about the different approaches to the issue, but when we come down to the bottom line, Are we making a choice that's in the best interest of those that we are supposed to be showing love for, our families? It can also involve the sacrifice of time. Will we sell our children's souls for the price of our time? We can get involved in so many things, even things which are good in and of themselves. Not just the work, but it can be hobbies or recreational activities or civic affairs or various different things. We can be pursuing our own educations, perhaps. Is it at the sacrifice of robbing time that our families need? And those of us who are involved extensively in the work of the Lord have got to heed the same warnings. Those of us who preach, those who function as elders, do not have the right to become so consumed in other aspects of that responsibility that our families are sacrificed in the process. I don't enjoy it a whole lot being away from my family for a week and a half, from the standpoint of realizing the extra burden that it places upon my wife. It's unthinkable to me, at my age and with my family circumstance, to consider being gone away from my family for 8, 10, 12, 14 weeks out of the year. I just can't imagine doing that. And we've got to recognize the responsibilities that are there. And all of us have our own judgments to make on those matters. But we've got a family to fight for. And if our pursuits in this life cause us to lose them, we fail. Sometimes we measure the success of preachers, I'm afraid, on the wrong basis. We want to get so hung up in numbers and so hung up in the winning of souls, and we want to see what he's doing in the world around us. And those things are important, and we need to be involved in those. But we need to realize that there are other elements to the success of a preacher. Noah is described as a preacher of righteousness and is held up as an example for us to emulate. Who did he save? 8 souls were on that ark. Noah and his family. If I lose my family in the process of converting the world, I've paid an awfully high price. The souls of the people around us are valuable, but we've got to recognize limitations on what we can do. And in some cases, it's my job to motivate others to take their share of the work, while I also take my responsibility at home. He also speaks in this verse about fighting for your wives. We as husbands have got to take that responsibility seriously. We are given a commandment to love our wives. It's not a suggestion to fall in love with our wives. It is a commandment to love. And we've got to understand what that love is. He's not dealing with an emotional feeling in the pit of the stomach that we fall into and fall out of. He is dealing with doing that which is in the best interest of the one that we love. That is a commandment that I can obey simply because I'm told to. Now, if the feeling in the pit of the stomach comes along the way somewhere, and the romantic association is there as well, that's a nice bonus. But the glue upon which that marriage is to be built and the responsibility that I have as a father and as a husband in my relationship then to my wife is a commandment to love. And we have got to take that seriously. That means I've got to do what's in her best interest. What can possibly be more important in my love of my wife than doing the things that will help her get to heaven? I've got to put her spiritual best interests above all else and to recognize the seriousness of that. There's no greater agony, I suppose, that one can endure than the loss of the soul of a child or a spouse. We can't always control every aspect of that. But what price is worth paying to contribute to that loss? We've got to fight for our families. We've got to realize that we are in a battle and we need to approach that battle with confidence of victory with God's help. Notice the language here in verse 14. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord great and awesome and fight for your family. He deals there with the fact that we need to remember the power of the Lord, that He is great and awesome. The confidence and the emphasis of our lives should not be on ourselves and what we can do, but on God and what He can do working through us. And we need to remember the Lord great and awesome. Do not be afraid of them, he says. There's a passage in Romans chapter 8 that has some similarity to that to remind us of the victory that we can win through God's power. In Romans 8 at verse 31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? As it is written, for your sake we are killed all day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor powers nor things present nor things to come nor height nor depth nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. He says there is no threat that can defeat us if we're fighting the battle with God. If he is on our side and we are doing it according to his way. But we can allow those things to defeat us. We can allow a concern for the fleshly things of this life, even those so-called necessities of life, to get us so wrapped up that we fail and that we are overcome. If God is for us, who can be against us? We need to fight the battle with a confidence of victory by the power of God. Well, back to Nehemiah chapter 4. The next few verses talk about the responsibility of fighting and fortifying. A couple of interesting concepts that are brought out here. In verse 15, it says, it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their counsel to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. And you notice, the enemy didn't stop when they avoided talking about the problem. The enemy stopped when they dealt with the problem and when they put up the defense. And that was the point I was mentioning a little bit earlier, that we can't avoid the issues, we've got to deal with them to put up the defense. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction, and with the other held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. There's a split responsibility in what's going on here. If there are two men together, one of them is working on construction, the other one is armed and prepared for battle. If there's one man who's moving back and forth in the work, in one hand he carries the supplies that are needed, the other carries a weapon. He is prepared and armed for the battle. And so half of the time, if you will, is being spent at building up the fortification, while the other half is being spent in fighting the battle. And I think there's an interesting application that we can recognize in that. We need to purge out evil while building up with good. The Bible constantly has that concept involved. That when we eliminate things from our lives, he gives us something else to replace them with. That we purge out the evil, we build up the good. That's our development as we as Christians are growing. We also need to realize that there are a couple of different aspects to the battle that's involved. That we are both fighting a battle in the sense of trying to conquer territory for Christ, reaching others with the gospel. And at the same time, we need to be building up the defenses, fortifying the city that's already there. And so it's the concept not only of what we sometimes term evangelism and the use of the term in carrying the gospel to the world, but edification in building up Christians. And the same thing has to go on in our families. We need to be developing in our children an interest in the souls of others, while we also are edifying and fortifying their souls and their spiritual strength. Well, then beginning at verse 19, he speaks of the strategy that was being used here as the people were given responsibility to rally to the battle. I'm going to twist that just a little bit and try to get it up there. In verse 19, then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on the wall. Therefore, wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of the men... I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. We'll get to that in a moment. Notice the strategy that's used here. Each one is given a responsibility. They are given a responsibility first for their own family. Fight for their family, their brothers, their sons, their daughters, their wives, their houses. So you get the picture that as many of these people were working in front of their own houses, that they'd be in a situation there that if an attack came, they would be right there to defend it. But if somebody's working over here and the attack comes over here, he says the trumpet will be blown and we can all rally to the place where the problem is and fight the battle there. How many times that applies in the situations that we have today? We all need to be on guard against Satan. We all have got to fight our own battles. But there are times when an attack is made somewhere else. The trumpet is sounded. The warning signs are there. The problem becomes apparent. We've got to rally to that situation and work with helping that person. We as Christians have a responsibility to help one another, to aid other saints, and to be helping others fight their battles. A couple of passages in the New Testament on this line. In Romans chapter 15, just in the concept of dealing with the burdens and such that we sometimes have to carry, and particularly the attitude of those who are strong in dealing with the burdens of the weak. In verse 1, he says, "We then who are strong ought to bear with the scruples of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, leading to edification." He says we need to be looking out for others. And those who are strong need to be recognizing the difficulties of the weak, the particular problems of understanding and such, and looking out for what's going to help build him up, help defend, help protect that person. Galatians chapter 6 deals with this in a little different fashion, dealing not just with the concept of weakness or misunderstanding, but of sin. He says in verse 1, "Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." That's the concept, again, of rallying to where the threat is. If the attack comes over here, we rally to that point. We help that person, help them bear the burdens, help them get through the difficulties. And if it's a matter of fault or sin or trespass, as is described here, then we've got to work to help them come back, to restore that one to a right relationship with God. That means we have a responsibility to be listening for trumpets. You see, the trumpet was used for several different things in the Old Testament. One of them was to sound an alarm, to warn of an attack. And that's the use that is being made of here in Nehemiah. Notice that Nehemiah talked about the fact that that one with the trumpet stayed with him. He was there with him. The one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. So if the word came of an attack being made, they could go to that. The trumpet would be sounded, and there would be a rallying of the forces to that point. Well, the trumpets today come in a lot of different forms and fashions. It means we've got to keep our eyes open, our ears open. We've got to be aware of the problems that others are facing to the extent that others will allow us to help. And we also need to recognize the strength that we can derive from one another in that sense. Can you imagine somebody in that process of building the wall in Jerusalem being there and having an attack come straight toward their house, their portion of the wall, which is only built up halfway? So here comes the threat, and this fellow says, sees Nehemiah and the trumpet bearer coming, the man ready to blow the trumpet. And he says, no, don't blow the trumpet. I don't want anybody else to know about this. This is my own problem. I'm going to take care of it. Now what happens in that case? He's refusing the help from others. So here comes the attack. How long do you think his house is going to stand? This was a serious enough problem. It involved the need for them to work together. He decides to fight it by himself. We know what happens. He's overcome. He can't by himself, in many cases, withstand the attack. Well, what happens after his house is overrun? And after this attack has come head on and he's refused help and he's overcome, then what happens? The trumpet's not sounded. Nobody else is alerted to the danger. How would you like to be his next-door neighbor at that point? And pretty quickly, the problem is spreading in other directions because this person refused the help that he needed to deal with it. We have a responsibility as Christians not only to offer help, but to be willing to accept it when we need it. And that's not always easy. Sometimes we can allow ourselves to be a little too proud to accept help when we need it. And pride is one of Satan's most effective roadblocks between here and heaven. He can use that to bring us down. These people realized that if they were going to fortify the city of Jerusalem, rebuild the wall, they had to work together. They had to accept help from each other and offer help to each other. We as Christians have got to be a caring people who want to help each other, want to build up and strengthen and deal with the challenges and the threats and the attacks that come from the outside. There are things that I face in my life that I'm not always able to deal with entirely by myself. I've got to go for help and seek that from others. And that's really what we ought to be doing. We ought to be willing to blow the trumpet. When we realize we're in over our head with something, or that there's something that's threatening us to the point that we probably need some assistance with it, we need to go get the assistance. And when it's offered to us, when somebody else realizes the attack is coming and blows the trumpet for us, seeks the help for us, brings the help to us, we need to be willing to accept it. to realize that there is an effort there for our concern. I've used my older daughter as an illustration a couple of times, and I almost feel guilty for slighting the younger one. I love her as much, and she comes up with some things too. There was an occasion about 3 years ago nearly, shortly before we moved from Cincinnati. Spring had broken, and it was about this time of year, almost exactly 3 years ago, and we had one of those days just like today, where it looks like it's going to be just an absolutely gorgeous day out there, nice warm weather. Had kids kind of pent up in the house for a good part of the winter, and we decided this was the time to take them out to a little community park there and let them play on the playground. And so we got out there, and there was a seesaw, or some call it a teeter-totter, there, that the kids got out to play on. Well, for a while, Benita and I had helped each of them. And at that time, Megan would have been almost 2 years old, I guess. So we got them out there, and we were playing with them on the seesaw. And one of us, I would get on one end of one, and maybe Heather on the other end, and Benita would get on with Megan, and we were taking them up and down. Well, then they got tired of that, as kids do pretty quickly, and took off for the swing set or something else. And so Benita and I went and sat down and just kind of watched them play and had a little time to talk or do some reading ourselves. And then we noticed that the girls decided to go back to the seesaw. So they both go over to the seesaws. There are several of them together here in one place. And Heather jumps on one of them, and Megan jumps on the other end. And they look up at us, and Megan looked over at Benita kind of like, wait a minute, this doesn't work quite the same. She wasn't talking very well at that point, but it was as if she was saying, why are we both down? You see, what they had done is they'd gotten on different ends of different seesaws. And so they were figuring they ought to be going up and down, but it didn't matter how hard one of them pushed down over here, it wasn't going to lift the other one. Sometimes I think we as Christians get on different ends of different seesaws, and therefore we wonder what's going on. Somebody comes to help us, to lift us up, and we avoid that. We get somewhere else just where we can stay down, and they're not going to be able to help us. We've got to cooperate to the extent that when somebody is seeking to lift us up, we'll accept the help. And we will allow them to encourage us and to challenge us, even to rebuke us if that's what it takes, but to lift us up. Because as long as we sit on opposite ends of different seesaws, we're not going to get very far as Christians. We've got to be able to work together. And that seesaw was the connection that allowed one to lift the other. We've got to have a connection in our relationship as Christians that will allow one to lift the other, not to act as if we're islands that can just exist separate from one another and not gain the benefit that's there. God knew what he was doing when he made the design that as people became children of his, as they became Christians, that they were added together, that they became a church. We can think of it as it's used sometimes in the universal sense, but he also shows that design of, as Paul describes it, joining himself to others, that there is to be a relationship between Christians, a connection between us, that we can help each other. And we recognize so many ways. The illustration's been used sometimes, and I think draws it very clearly, about the problem that we have when we refuse that help, whether it's the encouragement we get from assembling together or just the help we can get from each other on a one-on-one basis as we work together. But about a man who had quit assembling with the Christians, and I know this is not the group that needs this particular illustration, except maybe as we can get the message across to others, but who had quit assembling with the local church and had just decided that he didn't need that to be a Christian. The fellow went over to talk to him about it, and I've forgotten the name and who was involved, but went over to talk to him about it and to try to encourage him to come back. And as they were sitting there, they were in front of the fireplace in this man's house that had a fire of live coals in it. And so they were just talking, and the fellow who was trying to encourage him took the little poker for the fireplace and kind of latched a hold of one of the coals and brushed it aside from the others. And they continued to talk a little bit about different things. Never said a word about the coal, never had to say much about the man's problem before he left. You know, that one coal separated from the fire doesn't stay hot very long, does it? There's an intent in God's design of putting us together, to be rallying to the battle and working together with each other. Well, back to Nehemiah chapter 4. We also need to recognize the fact that we must never let down the guard, and I hope that's high enough you can see it there. We must never let down the guard. Verse 21. So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, took off our clothes. I'm glad they put this last note in there. Except that everyone took them off for washing. See what they were doing? Constant guard against the threat of attack. That even those who had been coming in from outside the city to work now stayed in the city. And they were constantly ready that even when it was your shift off and you were asleep, you were on call, ready to go back to the battle and to be involved again in the fight. And that was the way they handled it. That they would work or guard from morning till night and be prepared at any time of the night to rally to that battle. Never let down the guard. Even though we're told all the way back there in verse, 15, the God had brought their counsel to nothing. The enemy's threat was seemingly lessened at this point, but they didn't let down the guard. 1 Peter chapter 5 makes the application for us in our own circumstances, dealing with that threat that Satan is constantly holding out there for us. He says in verse 8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world." We've got to be on guard constantly, to be sober, to be vigilant, to be watchful. Some versions, I believe, use the word circumspect in that passage, and that helps to get the concept across, that we are looking around and aware of the danger, the threat that's coming toward us. We've got to constantly be on guard, never letting down the guard, because Satan strikes when and where we least expect him. So we've got to be looking out all the time. There's a lot of material in this book of Nehemiah. We've chosen out just one section and one example of a lesson from it. There's a lot of material there. You know, we hear a lot of times, and we avoid the terminology sometimes, as the denominational world has used it so extensively, about the concept of revival. But there is a biblical concept of revival, and Nehemiah is one of the revival books of the Bible. That it was dealing with the concept of trying to breathe new life, to revive again a nation, a city that needed to be at work. And that's the thought of that song we sometimes sing, "Revive Us Again." That's what Nehemiah was there to do. That's what Ezra had come to do about 15 years earlier. That's what Haggai and Zechariah had done some 80 years before that. They were there for the purpose of reviving the people. We need to take the challenge too and to be willing to fight for our families. Okay, are there questions or comments regarding the material we've looked at there this morning? Had some good comments yesterday, and there may be some others that I want to add today. As far as like where we were talking about the one nation being brought against another, yeah, I think that there's indication in the Bible that he does, with one exception perhaps. He often at that time sent a direct revelation of what was going on, a warning to the people as through the prophets. That's what basically most of the Old Testament prophets were doing. We don't have that today. We've got an understanding from the Scriptures of his general role. But he is still the ruler of nations. He has still, for example, in the Bible, it carries us up as far as the Roman Empire and his decision on that. Jerusalem's destruction is presented for us in several of the places in the Gospels as the coming of the Lord. It was a judgment being brought by God. And the principles that are set there from way back in the Old Testament, that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people, still, I believe, is very much in effect today. God has never just resigned the post of being Lord of lords and King of kings. Revelation 1, in, of course, dealing as he brings judgment there. In verse 5, he describes himself as the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, and the ruler over the kings of the earth. And he goes on to establish in that book that he had that rule and was going to exercise his power of judgment upon an empire there, just as clearly as he did in Daniel, for example, with Nebuchadnezzar, time after time through the Old Testament. And I believe that's a warning to us. We were studying in Isaiah in the adult class that we just finished up last term at home. And one of the things that was interesting there, we sometimes talk, I'll stray for a moment here to come back and make a point. We sometimes talk about the fact that God preserved Israel all through the Old Testament, though they didn't deserve to be preserved. And we talk about the reason for that he had a promise to fulfill. That is very true. Isaiah 65, from verses 8 to 10, brings that out very clearly, that that was the purpose that he kept them alive. As the new wine is found in the cluster, and one says, do not destroy it, for a blessing is in it, so I will do for my servant's sake, that I may not destroy them all. I will bring forth descendants from Jacob, and from Judah, an heir of my mountains. My elect shall inherit it, and my servants shall dwell there. Sharon shall be a fold of flocks, the valley of Achor a place for herds to lie down, for my people who have sought me. And what we talked about in class, in connection to your question there, Jim, is that God kept Israel alive when they didn't deserve it, because he had made a promise to Abraham that had to be fulfilled in Christ. The nation had to be preserved so that Christ could come. And that was what kept them alive. It was not their righteousness that kept them alive. It was the fact that God had plans for them. Now, what plans does God have that demands that he keep the United States of America alive? What role does this nation fulfill that we've got to exist, as Israel had to exist for a certain time period? When God finished with his plans with Israel, they were out of the picture. Within 40 years of the death of Christ, Jerusalem was destroyed. The nation was brought to an end. And I think what that needs to remind us of is that we need to be focusing on that concept of righteousness. The salvation of this nation is not going to be dependent upon nuclear arms or nuclear arms treaties. It's not going to be dependent upon the strength of our armies. It's going to be dependent upon the work that you and I do sitting down across kitchen tables, teaching people the gospel of Christ. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And if we want our nation to stand, if we want our children and grandchildren to know the freedoms of the United States as we have enjoyed them, then we better be teaching our neighbors and teaching them the message of Christ, because that's the only assured means of preserving a nation. And I'll tell you, I'm a little concerned, because we are in a nation that has so much opportunity to know the gospel, and we're not doing very well in our obedience to God.